On these programmes, I try not to be too historically specific, because we do talk to each other a little bit before they go out. We're not thinking of this as some kind of instant radio journalism. These are discussions. I mean, you know, the very title of it, that we're going to discuss the ideas of Marshall McLuhan and Karl Marx over the over Frank Zappa. We're not giving people the news of today. But just to begin this particular show, I'm going to refer to something that's happened only last week, which is I went to Germany to the Zappanale, which is a Frank Zappa festival and set up in the old communist area of Germany. And there are very specific reasons why that's so, which I find interesting and still haven't dug to the bottom of. And Bob, can you hear strange swishing sounds?
Yeah, that's... Hey, Carolyn. Carolyn's in the kitchen. It's coming through. Ah. I guess you didn't know.
Hey, what's Carolyn doing, Bob? We've got to know what she's doing. We have to satisfy the curiosity of the listeners, and I hope all listeners to this program are interested in sounds as well as us talking. What was that swishing noise?
Carolyn, what is that swishing noise?
Water pouring.
Ah. What are you doing with it?
Making...
The water turn black?
If you like.
No, we don't like. We want to know the truth. What were you doing with the water, Carolyn? Are you boiling water to boil an egg? I know it's in the morning for you in Hawaii area.
No, it's 12:30. It's noon hour.
Oh, it's noon? Right. So, Carolyn, tell me what you were doing, please. Otherwise, I can't carry on with the program. If I hear a funny noise, I've got to know what it is.
We have to know what you're doing. Ben's demanding to know what you're doing.
I'm washing some vegetables.
Ah, good. Right, well, that's solved. Yeah, vegetables is a bit unspecific. Can you tell me which vegetables, please?
Which vegetables?
I went up to the Hui garden today that I work on and dug up a lot of big arugula plants and picked some chard and some collards and created such a mess of vegetables that I had to come home and wash them all out.
Oh, Carolyn, you live such a nice life. It just sounds beautiful, picking all those vegetables up and washing them out.
Yes, he said you live such a nice life picking all those vegetables. And she can't really hear this. I pulled the plug out. But
oh, right, I see.
Oh, no, now she can.
For a brief moment there, Bob. Hey, this is chaos on the Bob and Ben Show. So unusual. I can hear an echo of my voice now. You see, we start with vegetables and we end up with chaos. This is the human condition.
Maybe because I unplugged the headphones.
Yeah, but we... Ah! And so, going to the... Thank you very much, Carolyn, for that intrusion of vegetables, which is completely relevant to everything I want to say, which is about the animal and the vegetable, and always with respect to the mineral. But the way I wanted to open the program was, Bob, by saying that having been to this festival and seeing all this stuff going on, all these people, that I wanted to ask you what the motivating part of our united devotion, in a way, to Frank Zappa was, that's different from being devoted to it. That we, you know, like, you've never been to the Zappanale, I don't think. You've never been to this festival. I go, but there's a whole part of it which I can't bear, which is the devotion side, which is turning to Zappa and believing in Zappa. And we were talking earlier about how we want to apply Zappa. And what is the difference, I mean, forget Zappa, say, between applying something and getting so involved with it you can't see your way out of it? I mean, once you have that idea, it seems to me a fantastic critical idea that you could apply to all kinds of areas of human activity. That maybe it's the great critical idea. Maybe this is our revolution. We're saying that there's a difference between mastering something so that you merely go inside it and understanding something so that you use it as something to go out to something else with. Does that tally with any way you think?
Yeah, I think all critical activity is based on that principle, what is called being anti-environmental. It's subliminal seduction. It's the basis of hypnosis, the basis of healing, the basis of trance, the basis of mediumship, the basis of being duped. So,
but I find it extraordinary.
Wait, Ben.
How you put it. I've got to interrupt you there. I'm sorry. That you begin with the word critical, which has a great long European tradition. It begins with Kant, it's German philosophy, the critical idea, and usually that is not understood by lots of people. And then you go into a slew of kind of 60s new age ways of thinking about things. And how can criticism lead towards spirituality and healing? It just, most of the people involved in spirituality and healing, if you say you want to be critical, say don't be nasty, that's bad, that's negative, we don't like criticism. How can you start with criticism and end up with healing?
I was going to say that I don't know if Christ said this, or I've heard Christians say this, I am maybe in this world but not of it. Have you heard that sentence?
It sounds familiar.
And so,
is this where you stand? You stand on Jesus's platform of I'm in this world but not of it?
No, I'm just making more absurd connections. You thought it was absurd to connect healing to the German critical school.
No, not absurd. Not absurd, Bob. I mean, wrong. I mean, I want you to trace it back and understand why I find it strange. I mean, I think I say I'm in this world, but not of it. Am I meant to say I'm of this world, but not in it? Which of or in? What was the difference anyway? You can't, and you have no choice about it. So, you know, it seems to me we should scrumple Jesus up as a theoretician and throw him out of the court. I mean, Marshall McLuhan or Karl Marx, Frank Zappa, I understand this Jesus person. I just don't get it.
You know, what is it? The preposition is the crux of the biscuit. The Christian says something, I may be in this world, but I'm not of it. I'm going to take that statement and see that McLuhan was close to it when he said, imagination is that faculty not embedded in any of the senses or any of the extensions of the senses. The whole thing of being creative is not to be controlled by the material you're creative with. And the drama of cognition, the drama of creativity, is how do you engage matter or substance or whatever your medium is and use it to stimulate your audience, yet not be creating more numbness, which usually the critical faculty is devoted to making people less numb. But that, of course, in the literary world becomes a numbing activity. The postmodernists have numbed themselves out. So I am of the Zappa world, but not in it. Or I am in the Zappa world, but not of it. Zappa is totally irrelevant to me. It's like the old, I love that line by T.S. Eliot, I got to use words when I talk to you. When people ask me about things, I know that Zappa is a figure. So it's like, well, I saw this guy on the street the other day. He called himself Frank Zappa. He was playing at Hyde Park. He was very good. I think he pointed out what I'm trying to illustrate. That's what Zappa is, just a passing reference, just like Finnegan's Wake and McLuhan. They're passing things. I'm not even involved in them. I'm trying to point out how I'm engaging in the present. And I don't find any useful markers for dealing with it, but I got to use markers to talk with anybody. And the markers I use get us in a rabbit hole. Part of the revolution would be to distract ourselves from what the mainstream rabbit holes that are being created. So we need more Zappanallies, more emphasis on Zappa, but I would not be of it. I would encourage it, but not show up. It's like an old friend of mine, you know, way back there when we were kids. He would say, "Okay, let's go do this," and he'd get everybody to charge, and everybody go running after to beat up somebody or something. And he'd hang back, and he didn't charge, but he'd fool everybody to charge at something. That I think is the essential activity of artists: charge and watch everybody go into there and get seduced by it, and you don't get in. You don't get your hands dirty. That's one way of answering your opening point.
certainly is a way of answering it, and I fell silent for the energetic disquisition and the passion which you're unleashing, which is a little bit unusual on Bob Men. Usually I'm the passionate one, so it was great to hear you say that, and I'm digesting it now. I'm thinking about what you're saying. I think I have to I've really got a problem with your idea of art as irresponsible, because I mean, obviously the function of the artist within this society is exactly the irresponsibility you're talking about, but there's a rebellious side of art which rebels against the rebellion.
I agree.
Which is the side of art I adhere to. You know, while the fogs are saying everything's about and I can't say these four letter words or we won't get on the radio, but everything's about that and drinking and drugging and being bad, you know, and just creating cacophony. And that's where I throw in Frank Zappa, not because I think everybody, you know, I want to sit and study Frank Zappa with you, but I use it as a way of thinking about a problem. So I go to music as a way of throwing what I'm thinking about into a proper light or a new light. So when I think of Zappa's solution to it, I think, well, it's not simply a matter of leading everybody in a nonsense direction. It's actually about pointing out how nonsense the direction is that all these people, given the name of artists, are leading everyone hither and thither. But the art I love is the art which gives me the ability to steer clear and do what I think is actually the rational and necessary thing for somebody like myself to do. So I like the sober side to crash in the midst of the cacophony of reckless pursuit of desires, without hemming in those desires, but by being a new stage.
New stage, yes. I don't want to keep saying, Ben, that's exactly what I meant.
I love it when you say that, Bob. It's fine. You know, I know we're getting along. You know, it's nice. You could reduce it just so you could blow a whistle or something. It might make it quicker.
Yeah, well, it's always interesting, and it illustrates my point that you start off disagreeing with what I said or want to clarify it, and then you end up saying what I meant. That's a very interesting process, which does illustrate the situation. You know,
this is the task of the therapist, Bob, is to articulate the ideas of the person on the couch. And tonight, uniquely, ladies and gentlemen, we have Bob Dobbs on the couch and me, Ben Watson. I'm the psychotherapist. Normally, it's the other way around for some reason, but we've reversed the roles, and this is what we're doing. You're on the couch, and I'm explaining to you what you really think.
No, that's exactly it. It took you 18 shows to recognize that I was being a therapist. Some of the audience noticed it. You've recognized it, and you realize you must jump to the other side. You must, quote, steer clear of being categorized as the person on the couch. So you're putting me on the couch, which I don't mind. That's great. This phrase, steering clear, was what I was referring to. You know, when you meet someone and you start talking, and then you say a few themes, their eyes glaze over, or they become automatic, and you know, oh, they've stopped there. They've got a red light there.
Yeah, I know exactly that feeling, yeah.
Yeah, they've got a red light there. Okay, I'm going to ease out of this conversation and go somewhere else, because I want to have vital interaction as much as possible. So then you go somewhere else, and you find someone vital, and it goes on longer and longer, and you might even sleep over with them, and it goes on for a few weeks, and then there's a red light shows up. And then you got to back off. I pride myself on having no red lights and can talk about anything and engage with anything, and I like artists that point to that method. And it doesn't mean that I want to be a painter or a filmmaker. I'm looking for interaction within any form of expression, and if there's no red light. And that includes the awareness that you've gone too far with the notion of having no red lights. You got to have a red light occasionally, which is what you bring in, as you just did. You know what I mean? And so it's this juggling, which I call tactility and you call the dialectic, the juggling of maintaining, steering clear of the situation, of being seduced, yet being seduced. That's the paradox of life. And but that's what.
Why do we do it? And I'd say our slogan would be to keep things interesting, that we really don't like being bored, which is why we're allergic to moral systems and probably allergic to a lot of political systems, which often turn into moral systems if they're not dialectical enough.
Exactly. If creation is a joke on us, that's the dilemma.
You mean creation with a capital C, meaning existence itself, rather than creation with a small C, meaning what we make ourselves?
No, I mean, I'm not sure I like capital C.
That confrontation.
It's like God's a jokester, you know. He created this world and we end up just having futile games. I think that is a big part of experience, and we do want more. We're happy, relaxed, and waiting for more. Humans want more. But it's tricky. You start finding a realm of moreness, it will quickly become numbing.
Well, this is conventional morality, Bob. I'm sorry we've brought it down here. We have highs and lows of our programs, and I think we've hit a low, because
where the heck is the morality?
Because you're saying, well, excess is great until it comes too much, and then stop it.
And no, that's the way the senses work. It will become boring, and then you've got to figure what you're going to find stimulating.
No, but by throwing what. You see, my slogan would be, what do we find interesting? Which is proposing a different side of pleasure. Because the consumerist idea of pleasure is simply that it's, you can measure it with accountancy. That I like drinking, so therefore if I have 10 bottles of whiskey, and I am 10 times as happy as if I have one bottle of whiskey. But experience proves that it's not a very good idea. That actually you don't enjoy that much whiskey, that it goes over the top. But that's not to say that the excessive involvement with whiskey at a particular time for someone couldn't be a revelatory and fantastic thing, particularly with other people and everybody unleashing themselves as drink allows people to do. I mean, I'm thoroughly keen on drink in that sense. But the mechanical idea that the mere quantity will improve what you're doing ignores the fact that humans, and here I'm going to be brave and state an anthropological maxim in the way that postmodernists don't like us doing and think it's oppressive to everybody to say this, that humans are happiest in interaction. That it's the interaction between them that's masked by the talk of money or drugs or alcohol or this amount or this amount, that the solitary competitive nature of the bourgeois individualism we're in at the moment makes everybody think that it's getting this and consuming this that makes you what you are, whereas in fact what you are is an ensemble of relations with other people, and it's getting those right which makes you happy. And that the reason that when you're 14 year old you want to drink so much beer and vomit on someone's shoes is because you need to do that with your peer group, because that's what you need to do, because I mean, I'm saying you do need to do it, but it's a social thing. It's a collective thing. It's part of other people. And if you do it all on your own, next stop suicide.
And Ben, you're now on the coach.
I'm on the couch. I thought I was on the sociological podium.
Well, again, you keep agreeing with me.
But maybe the sociologists on the podium should be put on the couch. I mean, we are arguing for we are mega intellectuals dealing with the horrible way that knowledge and thought has been separated by the various powers that be and the academy and so on. So we say a sociologist on the podium telling us about society should be put on the couch and should have to reveal their unconscious and talk to a psychotherapist, that psychology should have some part to play in taking, you know, understanding what that person is doing, don't we? I mean, we are an attack. And this is where maybe Karl Marx and Marshall McLuhan agree, that we are an attack on the separation of disciplines, the separation of knowledges in the way that knowledge is dealt with in straight society, in mainstream society.
Yes, and I just thought that you said I brought up a moral principle that put the show from your perspective into a trough. Those are your red lights. You keep coming up with red lights in response to what I'm saying.
Ah, you didn't listen to what I just said. You're replying to what I said 3 minutes ago, but that's fine. I'd like to deal with that. I mean, I think what I just said was a fantastic, brilliant, glittering balloon, but let it float away and let's get back to morals and red lights.
Yes, no, I heard what you said.
It's in there somewhere.
You keep agreeing with me. And yet you think you're not agreeing with me, or sometimes you think you are, and then you veer off. I never know when you're going to veer off and interpret that I put up a red light or something. The hypnotism of sensory existence cannot go on without it flipping into pain. Now, that happens all the time in experience. Like, during our shows, the majority of shows we've done, you report after that it had highs and lows. Do you realize I have never had a low during our shows? I have no comprehension of lowness, or it's just all intense for me. That's why I find it funny that you go on these up and down roller coaster emotions. I don't know, so I'm calling that a moral red light response. I mean, how come it's not all green for you?
Bob, let me explain it differently. I was appealing to your intellectual higher nature. I was appealing to you in a strangely Cambridge University kind of way, which is admitting that possibly we'd indulge in something which is a bit low for us to think or do. And I kind of regret the way I'm using this rhetoric, because in many ways my life has been a reaction against this way of thinking about things. But it's a certain rhetorical strategy, which I find quite amusing, is, let me give you an example. It's when I had a big spat with Derek Bailey, who's the guitarist that after Frank Zappa I admire most, in terms of not simply how he played the guitar. Well, if you play guitar, it invokes a whole system of attitude, and I thought Derek Bailey was the most radical guitarist I'd heard since Frank Zappa. Now, I was disagreeing with Derek Bailey. I was trying to write his biography, and it came to a point where he insulted Thelonious Monk, and particularly late Thelonious Monk, and I love late Thelonious Monk. I think that quartet he formed with... what's he called? And it's bad in jazz when you forget names. But anyway, I think late Thelonious Monk is terrific. And he really disagreed. And I went home crying. And
literally?
Yeah. No, literally. Yeah, going to the bus, I was crying. Because he was my hero about music. And he just said something else I really loved was complete rubbish and bad, and my world was splitting apart. Yeah, you know, when you love music, it can feel like that. It's akin to love. And I got on the bus and went home, and then I wrote a letter to Derek Bailey explaining what I thought, and then he wrote a postcard back. And one of the things he said on the postcard was, well, we're having this big debate, but at least we haven't stooped to email. You know?
That was his response?
Well, that was one of his responses in this big thing about Thelonious Monk. And I love that idea of two people talking and saying, we could have gone that low. I'm sorry, this is a very ridiculously, to explain what I mean. But what I mean is, The rhetoric I was using, what I was saying to you, Bob, haven't we got a bit low here? We're hitting morals. Things are getting really bad. It's meant to be a little a green light of humour to you to say that haven't it all got a bit bad, but I'm kind of trying to twinkle about it in the way that he was when he was saying, you know, at least we haven't stooped to email. It's like you're having a debate with someone and it's saying, well, it's going up and down. And it was Derek's awareness, even when we were debating, of the historical nature of what we were doing that I loved. And that I love about you, Bob, because you assume that every statement you make is historical, that you don't accept the general alienation people have about their expression, that most people, and probably you, and often me, I know, I walk around with a boot on my head thinking I'm rubbish, I'm not the centre of things, I'm not it, you know? And that idea that, well, you know, maybe we should, you know, to stoop to email. It's fantastic because it's the idea that I'm not talking about pro-email or anti-email. I'm talking about somebody having the humour to think of other people observing us doing this stuff and thinking that we are performing in a wide world, which is the whole of history and the whole universe, that we are all artists, that we all could be as fantastic as Andy Warhol. In fact, we are. In fact, we're better. And that idea of your ordinary life being the thing which should be conceived with elegance and, you know, as regards eternity and everything judging you, that idea that, you know, we should really, you know, even if it's just two people talking to each other on postcards, you know, we should say, well, at least we didn't stoop to email. It's like, for me, observing is imagining people writing biographies of you and thinking about you from the outside. So it's that idea of, and then other people, you know, will call it complete arrogant self-deluding nonsense, you know, that we think other people care about us that much, but it's not really that. It's a principle that we are the center of the universe. Our experience now, the experience of our listeners listening to us now, is the point of the whole thing. This is the only thing, and everything else is some kind of pressure on you, and you, we've got to fight that back. We've got to be here now, and this is it, and not feel guilty or feel bad or feel that this isn't the right thing.
I've always had that attitude. I think of when I met Gamma at the Martian Embassy. There was a guy who could respond to the importance of the moment. I want people, when they meet me, they should recognize that this is going to be the greatest time in their life talking to me. And I will appreciate them. That's why there's no red lights, but they block it. The sense of self-love creates a sense of community. That's what you're getting at here. And yeah, it's the ability to ride that.
Yeah,
to live it.
Yeah, it's the ability to, and this is what Frank Zappa can do with music, is to make musicians feel that they are totally going for it and it's totally them, but integrate it in something which is not simply, you know, the famous old self-indulgent guitar solo, all those boring phrases used to close down what could happen in music. It's the idea that absolute freedom of the individual would not be oppressive to other people. That idea, that the idea of hemming it in all the time, moral systems is the only way forward, is the whole, I mean, politics has disappeared in the world today. All we have is some kind of ethical charity system where if I sign the right docket and pay this money, I'm a good person. And nobody is saying, but what is the me that really likes this or doesn't like this? And this is the big problem to me, that we have a Christian hangover that thinks if I find the real me, it'll be bad because we're sinful.
The two quotes come up. I'm sorry we invoke it, but had some insights as you were saying this.
Bob, I love it if you come up with a quote. I mean, quotes are the hard little signposts in other people's thinking that we use to orient our thoughts. So a few quotes, you know, I'm absolutely open to those. You know I am. I like it when you find a quote.
Yeah, I'm thinking of a November, and I always like to cite my archival memory. Around November 1970, Zappa in an interview, I think it was about 200 motels, and the interviewer says, well, how can anybody deal with all this Zappa universe? Didn't use that phrase, but he meant that. He was overloaded by Zappa. And Zappa says, the point is that I imagine there's someone out there in the universe who's getting this beyond their wildest comprehensions and is really digging it. See, he was looking for one person to respond that way. That was who his audience was. That there was someone. You were evoking a minute ago.
It's a beautiful quote that you kind of mashed up there.
Yeah.
And it was a delightful encouragement to myself, anyway. I don't know if it was an encouragement to you, but it was an encouragement to me, having wild fantasies about what Frank Zappa was, that when he said that our art is a special art in an environment hostile to dreamers, that I felt his art's directed to me. Now, every commercial art flatters somebody and says that. But he included the hostile environment, and that's not very usual. Usually commercial systems simply stroke you and say you're cool and this is how to be and teach you things and that's it. But he was saying we make a special art and an environment hostile to dreamers. And yeah, and let me get on to the point that you were really making, which is somewhere out there in the audience understands what we're doing and he's getting off beyond his wildest dreams.
Right. That's perfect. I love that. That's what we're trying to express here.
But he was trying to, the extraordinary thing, he was targeting the slightly over-intellectual, under-intellectual, problematic listener involved with mass culture who's found the mothers of invention. He was putting his finger on us. Well, that's what I feel. I can't speak for you, but I feel he put his finger on me.
No, absolutely. That's why I bring it up. You remind me of that.
Yeah.
We remind ourselves of that.
And I found, despite the weight of my cultural upbringing and my readings of E.H. Gombrich and Art and Illusion and my understanding of Volheim and my understanding of art history and my understanding, look, I bloody knew culture. You know, European culture was no problem for me. I was a fucking master of it, and we don't use those words, but sometimes you just have to. And this thing came along, this Frank Zappa thing, and when he said that, it was like the pink central point, right? The little wiggling arsehole of the fly looking at you, blinking at you, you know? It was like, when he said that, it was just like he really knew what he was doing to me. It was really clear. It was like a little red eye looking at me. And that is when I decided, here is somebody that relates, can conquer all my European culture, can relate it to R&B and the whole thing that's happened in the States. He's found the bridge. This is the link. This is the tiny thread-like link between the two. And without that link, you can't relate them. And you can be on one side or the other, but you're boring. And that's the point.
Yeah, no, I'm really good at finding, pressing your buttons with these Kim Zappa quotes. That's why you know I'm on the same team. I read that in New York City in November of 70. I remember reading, buying the paper and reading it. Now, you probably didn't read it for about 8 years, 10 years later,
absolutely,
right?
It was some photocopy that Danny Houston had in his, you know, sordid flat, you know, and he's graying photocopy you bring out and we like have to study it, like we were collecting it. It was the stuff from the past. We were like the Renaissance, finding old bits of Greek sculpture and trying to reconstruct this amazing culture.
Yeah, you were rebuilding Bob's mind, because I walked around for 30 years before I found someone who appreciated that quote. I had that quote. I'd be waving at people, do you read this? It's like litmus test. What do you get from that? They wouldn't get anything from it. You know what I mean? So I'm walking around looking for, not an honest man, looking for someone who understands that quote. The new
cynical
agenda.
I just want to ask our listeners, how do you deal with stupid people? And why do you tolerate them? That we're so indoctrinated with tolerance in this postmodern universe that intolerance is the thing that we have to have against stupidity. We have to insist.
This brings up the
This is our Lewisian moment, isn't it, Bob? Here.
Yes. Let me bring up the complementary parallel quote, which answers what you just said. I always appreciate Zappa saying somewhere back then, don't know if I, it might have been an interview I read later, but it happened in the 60s or 70s. He says the reason he doesn't like love songs is that he takes it for granted that people love each other. Or I don't know if that's the way he said it, that there's love. Why sing about that? That's a given.
That's amazing. I'd like to see that in black and white. I mean, my Zappological, boring librarian psych, it feels skeptical, because it's a sort of quote I would really...
That. You don't know
no,
that
no,
quote?
No. It's like exactly what I'd like. I mean, I understand it more now, and it was very confusing when I was 19, 20, and beginning sexual explorations, and my psyche was very sadomasochistic, and Zappa's songs seemed to support it, but it was seen to really anti-women, and I couldn't, you know, it was a rocky thing to go through, and then the women I knew were feminists, and this wasn't allowed, and this, and you know, it was difficult. And I'm working towards now an understanding of Zappa as being an older brother, and watching his younger sisters and brothers being little babies and being changed, and watching, you know, how I think he changed nappies, because how else would he understood that it all goes through, you know, Mr. Green Jeans, you know, you eat your celery and your beans and it goes through your gut. And I only found that becoming a father 4 years ago, that when you change a baby's nappy, what they've eaten comes through into the nappy. And then I thought, this is ridiculous. Why am I being amazed by this? I mean, I did a biology A level. You know, I studied biology at school. You know, I'm not stupid. But then I realised that I'd been, that I treated toilets as non-cosmic or as cosmic or separated. You know, I went and did it. And I lost it. I didn't think about it. Well, I wiped my bottom. But I didn't think about the relationship between what I ate and what went through.
You became a given. You became hypnotized by a process you didn't notice. You became it rather than had a critical, clear view of it.
Yeah, well, but on the other hand, if your body's working, you're eating and it's going through, there's no need to keep staring at a shit. I mean, in Germany, they have special toilets with a ledge.
There's the point there.
No, but they do. Do you know about German toilets with a ledge?
Yeah, yeah.
You know about that.
Yeah, so I've when been you to Germany have a many times.
What we the, call you poo to use because of you know I've got two young children. I think use this as language. If you have a shit, you shit onto a ledge so you can have a look at it before you flush it away, because they believe in staring at that stuff and understanding your body through that stuff. And I think Frank had a lot of experience of his younger brothers and sisters, and I think he changed nappies, and I think he had a really female view of the human animal. And this was I completely couldn't understand that when I was trying to defend Illinois Enema Bandit to my feminist friends back in 1979. When's Illinois Enema Bandit? About that time. You know, it was an impossible contradiction. I liked the music and it was offensive and terrible. It was just awful. But now, I think that Frank's particular point of view comes from a more female understanding of what we really are, because I think under this particular system, women are more privileged to understand biological processes. And me, because I'm just hearing one now, which is Mordecai waking up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I might be going to sleep again. No.
No.
No, I'll have to ask you to talk through us this, Bob. You've done it once before.
Okay, the what I like is the McLuhan or Zappa shows that he does not have the red light going on in him, because when he says that love is given is a given. What you mean by stupidity, Ben, is people not getting that. But also part of love is realizing why people don't get that. And the red light, the green light, the red light is a dialectic. So when Zappa thought that there was someone getting it off beyond their wildest comprehensions, whatever the phrase was.
Comprehensions is better. Yeah, that's closer. Beyond the wildest comprehension, yeah.
Yeah, and the point is that I think that there's someone, this show is for that person or more, who are understanding what we're doing and saying and getting off on it. Beyond their wildest red lights. Are you back? You're not back. So the what's interesting is that I find these quotes that Ben, they're so good that Ben doesn't even believe the second quote. But he knows it's there. He knows that's what he meant. That's what he liked in Zappa.
Okay, I'm back again. And you're talking to the audience as if I'm not there. But I'm, you know, hanging around.
You did hear what I said.
Well, I heard stuff about red lights. And the red lights make me bridle. I find it a crude, very traffic-oriented, car-oriented way of interpreting the dialectic, you know? I mean, You know, the American system
is
such a product.
Well, let's not get distracted by what you don't like.
No. It's not what I don't like, or it's the world we're in. You know, the car has produced wars for oil. It's produced fast food. You know, the burger you could eat in your car with one hand. It's produced tarmac everywhere with roads. It's produced, you know, the car is the curse of today. So to use a metaphor of traffic lights is just, to me, it makes me think, you know, red, green, you know, no traffic lights. And then you admit, well, you need a little bit of red anyway. So what's the use of, you know, no red? I mean, Bob, you know, it's you got to drop it. I can't get on with this, like, you know, I don't have any red lights except when I do. You know, it's silly. You know, we can't have that.
Yeah, so again, I'm in the therapist position. I'm winning this point. I'm putting you back on the coach. This is
I'm on the couch. Well, just because I express myself. As soon as you express yourself on the couch. But that's so bourgeois, man, because it's like every artist is on the couch. You know, only the person who doesn't say anything is like the therapist. And I've never understand therapists, because it's the rapist, you know? If you look at it the other way, you know, it's tough. Assignment, but about the red lights and so on, can you get back to what you were saying while I was taking Mordecai to his mother?
Yeah, I just think it's great the way I can come up with key quotes that express what you appreciate about Zappa and what he communicated. Wait, he felt that he got what you thought one needed to get.
Well, that's because, Bob, we saw the same things, because we are modernists. We come from understanding Wyndham Lewis.
We're not modernists, Ben. We're alive. You know, let's not use a category. We're living in the present. We're the most alive consumers on the planet.
And part of that might be refusing the tide of denial of a certain period of culture that existed, which has been dissed as modernism. It might be part of being alive now, might be saying all this onslaughts of attacks on this thing called modernism are slurs and lies. You know, we don't agree with it. You know, to be alive now, I think you have to be a modernist. And when I say modernist, I mean first-time modernism. I mean, you know, down with the Victorians, up with, like, square angles, you know, clarity, rationality, and then if something isn't clear, let's understand it. Freud.
Yeah, it's interesting that Zappa is always reviewed in the consumer press as a wild maniac. And then they would interview him and find out, be shocked at how rational he appeared to them to be. And Zappa, when I talked to one of his engineers, I don't know if it was Bob Stone or the other Bob, he said, "I'm a rational person." And I knew that he was a victim of the Zappa cult, that he was just imitating what his boss had taught him to say. But it was a reflection of Zappa was the most rational. Even now, we can bring in your mediumship. Even the Evergreens said that Zappa, and the Evergreens were channeled through Michael Blake Reed, and they're the ones who brought in the Zappas that I interviewed and posted after Zappa died. And we're hoping the audience has got some red lights about this, because I'm going to annihilate them. You keep your green light going. The thing is the Evergreens themselves said that Frank Zappa was one of the most reasonable, rational, might have been the word they used, persons on the planet. Now, you tell me, would there be five other people on the planet who would agree with that statement? No. This is back in 1980, about. You realize that, Ben? They knew that this maniac, that was his public image, who ate dog shit, you know, at a buffet or something.
No, it wasn't. He ate a turd on stage, a fan chat. There, you haven't even got the wrong story right. It wasn't dog shit.
No, wait a minute. I don't want to waste time on it. So
it's Mordecai who ate dog shit once.
I said buffet because that was his alibi. He said the only time he ever ate shit was some buffet
in a village in
Arkansas. Look, I can even quote the place.
No, it was the village in. Even
was it?
Yeah, even went against a corporate thing that could sue you.
But the point is that look at this image. It's always the mass mind is always wrong, yet it is the most creative spiritual activity in human life. This is another paradox.
That's not a paradox. That's actuality. I mean, you say an actuality and you call it a paradox. It's a paradox according to people who think wrong.
That's right.
We're thinking right. So to us, it's not a paradox. The mass mind goes ahead of the intellectuals. This is a thing that education doesn't understand. Yeah. This is why, you know, Frank Zappa was geared right into it. He learned from R&B. He learned from the underclass. He learned down there, there are truths, which up here, he didn't like higher education. He was really kicking against it. From his class background, he should have gone into it, but he didn't like it. It was, for him, useless.
Was Victorianism.
Down there was something really exciting. Now that I call class struggle. You call it different controls over media, but we are coming to a similar area, you know, when we talk about this, because it seems to me very few people have grasped that fact. You know, that that it comes from beneath, because everybody thinks media comes from speculation from on top, don't they? You know, every rock band thinks, well, you're not a rock band until somebody gives you money and it comes from above and it's corporate, and you know, whereas actually all the successful, really successful rock bands all start out actually building audiences themselves and coming from below. So, you know, I think Walter Ullmann, with his theory of ascending or descending theories of power, the way he analyzed the Middle Ages, would have a lot to tell us about what's going on now.
Yeah, what was the error in Wilhelm Reich's thinking?
Going to America.
Okay, that's a good answer, but taking his philosophy...
Well, that's a cheap answer, Bob. I don't really mean going to America. I mean being defeated in Europe and having to flee to America. I'm not slagging off America for receiving him, although they didn't give him a good time. You know, I don't really mean going to, you know, you're not free. He wasn't free to go to America. You know, he fled. You know, the real problem with Wilhelm Reich is Nazism. The real problem is the extermination of all the ideas Wilhelm Reich was developing and should have been debated by real situations. I mean, in Bolshevik Russia, in the first years of the revolution, they set up Freudian orphanages and really, you know, people really working on the ideas we agree with, really in control of society. And when that gets crushed, you flee. So Wilhelm Reich ended up in America, and I think he went mad. I mean, because he was trying to maintain his ideas of absolute subject-object change, but without any political way of making it come true. It became kind of quack stuff. I know you're closer to that than I am, I mean, with ideas of alternative medicine and so on. But I think when you start telling people that, well, if you listen to me, you're a philosopher and you believe it when you pay me, you know, I'm skeptical of that. I'm political. I think ideas have to be a good idea that somebody will adopt, and which is why I prefer you to J.R. Dobbs, Bob Dobbs, the official person of the Church of Scientology.
Yeah.
Because when I contacted them, all they wanted was their $10, or they wouldn't talk to me without their $10 or whatever it was to subscribe. And I was thinking, well, but I agree with what you're doing. Why aren't you talking to me as a peer? And
that's right.
There has to be a level of communication in which we're not making money from people. That once you're making money, something happens to communication. I think Frank Zappa is saying that all the time. Though I have to say, I meet a lot of Zappa fans that just think he's a fantastic guitar player, you know, brilliant arranger, great composer. I don't think he's attacking money at all. And I find it very confusing. You know, because
I'd like to go to Zappanally and give a lecture on how Zappa was not a musician. Oh. That's where I would begin. Can you imagine that?
It would be lovely, Bob. But the thing I've learned with the Zappanally is because it comes from communist, ex-communist East Germany, that the Zappanally, the older people, the fans that you really want to talk to, the Zappa fans from way back who set up the festival, they don't talk English. They were taught Russian in school, you know? Mm-hmm. That's what the division meant. So communication's difficult, because the first time I went there, I gave a lecture on Frank Zappa and Hegel. You know, I'd take on the most difficult German philosopher. I was going to lecture Germans on Hegel. You know, I felt so proud. But when I got there, Esther, my partner, mother of my children, translated it into German, gave out a leaflet to everybody with the whole thing translated, but you know, that communication was hard to have. You know, you can't quite go there and just have fun with ideas the way we have on the radio. You know, it's music. You have to prove it with music. I proved it slightly by, you know, over the years going there by my ability to be a buffoon on stage with the Muffin Men or Paul Green's School of Rock or what have you. You know, I've kind of proved myself, but you have to prove yourself as somebody who's freaky and, you know, you can't do it with ideas there because there's not enough English language comprehension. But it's all dying to get it. This is my frustration, that the stuff we're talking about is desperately needed at the Zappanale, you know?
I agree.
Exactly, you know, we should have lectures on Wyndham Lewis and modernism and what happened to, you know, what happened to everything. You know, it should become an alternative university in the world.
That's right.
It should be there teaching.
Any gathering should become the ultimate university immediately, and there should be people who want to make it that immediately.
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't want to just sit there and watch Terry Bozzio or something. You know, they should say, no, get that. We don't need that.
Well, we want to engage. I sympathize with the desire to watch Terry Bozzio, you know. I mean, on the Zappa records, he's such a funny, sympathetic character and such a drummer, torrential drummer, that I was sort of keen to hear it. And it's just when somebody gets that bloated with their own fusion-esque reputation that they're going to give you a little bit of tinkering around on their drums as like the whole show. Everybody was very disappointed. So that's what happened there.
Okay. I want to respond to these great themes you're raising.
You got 4 minutes.
Yeah, I do think that our conversation is the greatest conversation going on the planet right now. I have, in the media, I have conversations, great conversations, privately, ongoing, living, no red lights. The vitality of my, they could energize, they could solve the energy crisis with the energy of my life that I have every day.
But you need a red light occasionally.
Oh, yeah, well, that's Carolyn.
Oh, you bourgeois.
Yeah, he's a bourgeois.
I didn't get Carolyn's last name. Could be another Carolyn.
Yeah, okay.
You're bourgeois thinking I met my wife.
But I'm so pleased on Bob and Ben 19, we had Carolyn's voice. That was fantastic, man. We should get her on more often.
Okay, no problem. We are going to... No, I won't go into that. Let's keep that as a surprise.
You got 3 minutes to wrap up, and it's all yours. You got 3 minutes to wrap up, and it's all yours.
Yeah. I want to point out that sensory existence is enthralling. Or existence. Why put sensory in front of it? But you have to have a kind of detachment, a twinkle in your eye, that recognizes weird to be existing. Quoting Zappa, 1970, New York Times, it's weird to be alive. That is the ascetic credo you must have. You cannot take seriously whatever you're doing in the moment completely.
Actual existence is weird. I like that. It's true. This is the freak-out philosophy.
Yes, yeah. You can see a therapist or anybody gets the red light when they think they're living. They think they've arrived at some place and they must maintain it. That's a big mistake. I never was born, never going to die. I never showed up. I'm here and I'll give you the best massage you ever could want. You know what I mean? Even though I'm not here. Look at Beefheart. I'm not really here. I just hang around for my friends. The thing is, you know, Zappa and Beefheart had that electric interchange. They got it among themselves. And then they wanted to just talk it. And they didn't have to do anything. They just started showing up and performing. And everybody fell in love with it because they got the vitality. And the vitality had nothing to do with anything that he ever trained himself to do. He just stayed in touch. As he said to the German customs guy, "What are you on, Frank?" He says, "I'm on duty." What does that mean to be on duty? It means you're not getting fooled by what's going on.
It also means...
But you pay attention to what you're engaging.
I'll tell you exactly what to be on duty is, Bob. It's to be a parent.
That's right.
It means just taking care of everything. To be a parent or a boss. In a sort of small, non-exploitative way. But it just means I'm looking after everything. His response was great because the border guard is getting, you know, what are you on? Which is like, you must be on some wild drug, which proves everything. And he goes, I'm on duty, I'm on duty, I'm on duty. And he says it again and again. And Zappa doesn't normally repeat. And he's talking about what he's actually doing, which is watching everything, making everything happen, and being absolutely conscious and trying really hard. And
being very gentle about it. You see, people used to be struck at how gentle and sort of nice Zappa was privately. You know what I mean?
Well, it might have been, but we only have 30 seconds left for the show, and so we have to conclude. And so we have to conclude that Frank Zappa was a weirdly gentle, kind of hard-working sort of problem.
Warrior.
Problem for you to think about. Folks.
Just like I am.
Goodbye. Goodbye, Bob. Your problem.
Thank you, Ben.